Welcome to Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. Joyous conversations about what the afterlife evidence and modern science combine to tell us is true about our one reality. You have nothing to fear. You are eternal and you are perfectly loved. Knowing the truth changes everything. Now, here's Roberta.
Welcome to Seek Reality. I'm Roberta Grimes and I'm delighted that you can be with us today. You know, the most difficult part of my nearly five decades spent deeply researching the afterlife was not figuring out what happens at and after death. There's so much amazingly consistent evidence that putting it all together was really pretty easy. No, what continued to frustrate me for decades more was the fact that the physics of the greater reality where the dead reside is so nonsensical from a material universe perspective. It was really only less than 20 years ago when we began to get pretty good quantum physics for dummies books that afterlife researchers began to understand that there is, in fact, a kind of material world nobody really much knows about, but that it's almost exactly what it is in the afterlife. For example, if you are someone who lives in the afterlife, you can think you want to go to the other side of the material universe and you're there in an eye blink. How is that possible? If you're in the afterlife, it's easy for you to speak by mind. It's easy for you to create anything you want out of what is a very different kind of matter that they have there. All of that made no sense until finally, we came to understand, we who are not physicists by at all, by any means, came to understand it's just a purer version of quantum mechanics. And in fact, as I've been telling you repeatedly, the greatest scientific discovery of the 20th century was made by Max Planck, who won the 1918 Nobel Prize in Physics as the father of quantum mechanics. That great discovery was the simple fact that what we experience in a limited way as human consciousness underlies all of reality. I'll give you quickly his two quotes just to start us off. You're familiar with them by now. In 1931, Dr. Planck said, "I regard consciousness as fundamental. I regard matter as derivative from consciousness. We cannot get behind consciousness. Everything that we talk about, everything that we regard as existing, postulates consciousness." Then in 1944, he said, and this to me is profound, "As a man who has devoted his whole life to the most clear-headed science, to the study of matter, I can tell you as a result of my research about atoms this much. There is no matter as such. All matter originates and exists only by virtue of a force which brings the particle of an atom to vibration and holds this most minute solar system of the atom together. We must assume behind this force the existence of a conscious and intelligent mind. This mind is the matrix of all matter." He was exactly right. It's just that, and when I have shared that quote, but by the way, with people who are physicists, most of them won't speak to me, but those who are say, "Oh, he couldn't have said that." Oh, yes, he did. So we have a guest today who, if only I had known him 30 years ago, of course, he would have been very young at the time. If I had known him then, I could have spared myself all this trouble and effort and pain in trying to figure out by myself, someone who never had a physics course in her life, what the heck is going on. As I think about it, and Bernardo, I have thought about this. If only I'd known you then, my life would have been so much simpler. So I'm thrilled to meet you today. Bernardo Kastrup has a PhD in computer engineering with specializations in artificial intelligence and reconfigurable computing. I'm not even going to ask him what that is. He's way over my head, I have to say. He's worked as a scientist in some of the world's foremost research laboratories, too, including, and I find this amazing, the European Organization for Nuclear Research, or CERN. And he has worked with world luminaries like Deepak Chopra, who we all love. He's a prolific writer. In fact, I first encountered his work in his Scientific American blog. I literally could not believe what I was reading, that someone knew so much. And I was excited about his brand new book, but this new volume, which is just out in April 2019, just a few days ago, really, as we are doing this recording, turns out to be the latest of seven books that together break the old discredited scientific dogma of materialism wide open. He doesn't even hesitate. The first of them was published in 2011. It's Rationalist Spirituality. I love that. An exploration of the meaning of life and existence informed by logic and science. Wow. Later that same year, I mean, he's so prolific, came Dreamed Up Reality, Diving into the Mind to Uncover the Astonishing Hidden Tale of Nature. The following year, 2012, he published Meaning in Absurdity, What Bizarre Phenomena Can Tell Us About the Nature of Reality. And then in 2014 came my very favorite title of all, Why Materialism is Baloney. How true skeptics know that there is no death and fathom answers to life, the universe, and everything. This man publishes a blog in Scientific Reality. It's like it makes your head explode to imagine how far we've come. Then in 2014 came, and then the next one is True Skeptics Know There Is No Death and Fathom Answers to Life, the Universe, and Everything. Don't you love that whole title? Materialism is baloney. The more I read it, the more I think I could never have written something like that, and I don't even care what scientists think of me. In 2015, he published Brief Peaks Beyond, critical essays on metaphysics, neuroscience, free will, skepticism, and culture. Let's wrap it all up. And then in 2016 came More Than the Allegory on Religious Myth, Truth, and Belief. So when I discovered he'd already done all this writing, I felt like an idiot. I had never known who he was before, but I'm thrilled to know him now. His new book, and this is our topic for today, although we'll barely scratch the surface of it in just less than an hour. It's called The Idea of the World, A Multidisciplinary Argument for the Mental Nature of Reality. Now, he writes like a scientist, but he writes in a way which is arresting. Even if you're not a scientist, you'll be able to understand what he's talking about. So he's one of the very few people who can speak both to working scientists who hate this whole idea and to the rest of us. I think that, and he's very young, thrilled to see where his future is. I think he is the future of a really much more enlightened and empowered physics, really, and that will be the gateway to a much better world, as we have been saying week after week. He is our really wonderful guest today, coming all the way from the Netherlands. Welcome, Dr. Kastrup. I am thrilled that you are here.
Thank you, Roberto. You've set the bar very high. I hope I don't disappoint today.
I sort of went on a video binge yesterday, and I read some things you had written, and then I watched some of your videos, so I don't think it's possible. I'm just hoping that I can keep up with you, frankly. Tell us a little bit about your background, because you had a very traditional, as I understand from what you said in your videos, you had a traditional background, not materialist, not religious. I mean, I'd rather not not spiritual, not religious, quite material. How did you get started on this?
Well, and if you're working in the world of science, and especially in the world of artificial intelligence, where people think a lot about consciousness, how do we create consciousness? Does it even make sense to talk about artificially creating consciousness? When you're immersed in that for years, eventually you conclude that the difficulties you're facing are because the assumptions you made very early on were wrong, and you've never come back to them, you've never examined them critically. You've just assumed them, and then you face all kinds of problems later on that are impossible to solve, like the hard problem of consciousness that people talk about today. So I went back and I started reviewing where my thinking went wrong. And what I discovered, at least to my own satisfaction, is that the very idea that consciousness needs to be created at all is nonsense. Consciousness is that within which creation takes place.
See, I heard you say that when you were speaking on Skeptico, and I thought, I wish I had ever had that insight, because that to me is an extraordinary one. We tend to, just make fun of them. It's like to be looking for consciousness at the source of it inside the brain is like, you know, looking for Frank Sinatra's voice and where it comes from inside your radio. It makes the same kind of sense. But no, you went right to the source of it. Could you give us a little of that? Because I thought what you said was just wonderful.
Well, you know, every explanation of nature that anybody puts forward needs to be grounded on what philosophers call an ontological primitive. Basically, it is that thing that exists and cannot be explained. And you can instead explain everything else in terms of that primitive. But the primitive itself, you just have to postulate it is there, it exists. There's nothing more you can say about it. And the reason is that you cannot keep on explaining one thing in terms of another forever. At some point, you hit rock bottom, and that's the primitive then. the mainstream theory of nature today is that matter, or the fields behind matter, like the quantum fields, that is the primitive, and consciousness somehow derives from that. What I'm trying to put forward is that consciousness is the primitive, because that's all you have known your entire life. You've known nothing else. Everything that people say, well, that it's outside consciousness, that's a theoretical inference. It's a postulate. It's an abstract concept, because we are always within consciousness. And as it turns out, we can explain all the patterns and regularities of reality in terms of consciousness alone. But that consciousness then is not a personal consciousness. It's not your individual consciousness. It's universal consciousness. And everything arises within that field of universal consciousness as patterns of excitations of consciousness. That's what I'm putting forward.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I got there from a totally different perspective, and actually derived a very similar set of conclusions. But what you've done is so much simpler and so much more profound. I really take my hat off to you. But since you got there from science, why is it that most scientists can't go there? And they can't.
Well, I think maybe privately they can. Most scientists are working fields that are unrelated to consciousness. In other words, fields that do not require you to have an answer for the nature of consciousness in order to do the work they do. And the reason for that is that if you look at the method of science, what science does, science tries to understand, model, and predict the behavior of nature. If you do A, then you get B. If you do B, then you get C. These are patterns and regularities of nature's behavior, what nature does in reaction to something, in reply to something. Scientists talk about querying nature, putting a question to nature. That's what an experiment is. You put a question to nature, and the answer is nature's behavior that arises as a consequence of your experiment. So it's all about behavior. It's not about essence. Science says nothing about what nature is in and
yes.
of itself. It only tells you how nature behaves. And therefore, for most scientists, there is very little need to understand what nature essentially is, because they are successful enough predicting nature's behavior, which is all you need to develop technology. It's like a five-year-old kid playing computer games. The kid understands how the game behaves and can win championships.
Oh, yes.
But the kid knows nothing about software and hardware and all the computer engineering
yes.
that the game ultimately is. Only a few scientists get faced with this problem of consciousness. I would say neuroscientists of consciousness get faced with it. People working in artificial intelligence, artificial consciousness, like I myself did, get faced with it. The others don't, and it's more comfortable for them to not face the question at all, because they can do their work just as well without spending energy trying to crack this problem.
Well, what about physicists, though? Because it's staring them right in the face. They step around it. It's like this is the big elephant in the room that nobody will really talk about in the field of physics, or at least that's the way it looks to me. I'm a junkie, by the way, of your magazine, Scientific American. I've been reading it for 30 years and finding it funnier and funnier as it went along, because they just seem not to be able to face this obvious problem, which you have so well articulated. What about them?
Yeah. I think only few physicists actually have to face it. You alluded to quantum mechanics. Most people doing quantum mechanics today are preoccupied with predicting behavior. The usual thing people say, shut up and calculate. If their theories...
right, it's all about the math, right, exactly.
Yes, if their theories predict the outcome of experiment correctly, that's all they need. They can win Nobel Prizes with that. There is a small community of physicists around a field called foundations of physics and philosophy of physics. Those are philosophers, not physicists, but they sit right on the border. Those guys have to face these questions. And what you see is that there is an ever-growing proliferation of theories about what nature actually is, which are then informed by quantum mechanics. There is no consensus in that field. And my personal opinion is that their inability to reach consensus is that we are prejudiced against this notion that the physical world itself is just an image, a representation in consciousness of something that is itself not essentially physical in the way that we normally define physicality, you know, definite physical properties, definite positions in space-time. That is physicality. And the idea is that physicality itself is a phenomenon in consciousness that arises from the interaction of our personal minds with the mental space out there. That interaction, that interference pattern, then creates the physical world around each one of us. People are prejudiced against this view, perhaps because it has been historically associated with religions, both East and West. Right. And they keep trying to find something objective and physical out there. And you have this proliferation of theories about these fantasies that people come up with about some objective physical world out there, which have nothing to do with the world we actually experience, because that would be inconsistent with the experiments. So they postulate all kinds of crazy things, and there is no consensus.
There doesn't seem to be one. It looks to me, because this has been something I've been struggling with all my life, watching them go off the rails, and it seems to have happened very early in the 20th century when we started to get excellent communications from the dead. I think this was deliberate, and it was being these communications were being researched by people who were serious researchers and written up, and they tried to get scientists to look at it, but they were staggering through this immense realization that quantum mechanics had just thrown all their ideas out the window. They had to deal with quantum mechanics. So they just decided they would make materialism a fundamental dogma. Believe it or not, you could find those words in print. The fundamental dogma of science is materialism. And that seems to have happened within the first decade of the 20th century. After that, a door closed. And I think that door is still closed today. What do you think?
Well, it's difficult to say. I think at a personal level, a lot of scientists are open to things not being exactly the way we've been told, or the way that the culture sort of tries to convince us that's going on. Professionally, it's trickier. It's more difficult. You know, people are trying to fight for tenure, and, you know, it's a tricky situation because of the cultural circumstances around it. I think at the early 20th century, as you mentioned, there was an opening to something more along the lines of mentality and consciousness being the base, the foundations of nature. The founders of quantum mechanics were certainly open to those ideas. But from the 50s on, what you see is an enormous effort by physicists to offer a tenable alternative to that would preserve this idea of a material world out there, of a real objective physical world outside mind. All kinds of things people came up with to try to reconcile experiment with this idea of a physical world, because experiments were contradicting this idea of a physical world. Right. And all kinds of theories were created. Since then, that backlash has been continuing. What has changed in the last decade or two is that a notion that is very important to materialism, in physics, it's technically called non-contextuality. It basically means that the outcome of an observation should not depend on another simultaneous observation. And the idea is if the physical world indeed consists of material objects outside mind, if I look at something in the physical world, what I see should not depend on what somebody else or the way somebody else is looking at something else. It turns out it does depend. It turns out that non-contextuality is false. The physical world is contextual. It's a function of your observation as a conscious being. And this was a prediction that was already made very early on in the early 20th century, but we have developed the technology to test it experimentally only towards the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s. And ever since, the technology has evolved more and more. We have closed more and more potential loopholes in the experiments until that a couple of years ago, it's basically a done deal. The universe is not non-contextual. It is contextual.
Isn't that amazing?
And that poses significant problems for materialism or mainstream physicalism, however you want to call it. And we are now in the middle of that sort of crisis in physics. We are living through a time, I think, that 100 years from now, people will look back and say, well, that was when it all happened.
You really think that? Because because I've been reading this magazine for so long, I have seen the change happen. But a lot of what I find in Scientific American, which is the only one of these I read, is sort of they keep posing the questions in ways that are more and more stumping them, especially if it's, as you say, practical questions rather, you know, what's really happening as opposed to let's use the math to figure this out. Here's a question, by the way, that I have asked several scientists, and I wonder if you can answer it. I mean, this is not meant to be a stumper because I have an answer to propose. Why is it, if the universe is, objectively real, why is it that math, which really is an invented human kind of science, isn't it? Why can we use math to study it?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Yeah, this question was asked for the first time in 1960 by a famous physicist at the time. He even wrote a paper about the amazing suitability of the language of math to explain the physical universe or to model and predict the behavior of nature. The thing about math, what makes math unique is that although it is clearly objective, in the sense that mathematicians around the world can all agree on the validity or invalidity of a mathematical statement, it is objective in that sense. It doesn't depend on your personal dispositions, your opinions. People can prove or disprove something, and everybody will agree with a proof or a disproof if it's properly done. It's objective. Mathematics is objective. However, it is not empirical. Mathematicians do not need to run an experiment to see if their statements are correct. And that's a unique combination. How can something be objective and yet fully mental? It's not empirical at all. How can there be objectivity across the minds of all mathematicians in the world? It's a very tricky thing to understand from a materialist point of view. From a materialist point of view, mind is generated by your brain inside your skull.
Yes.
And it's insulated from the rest of the world by your skull. So my mind is fundamentally separate from yours and from everybody else's because my mind is insulated inside my head. So how can we have mental objectivity if our heads are not, if our minds are not connected? And moreover, how can the axioms, the self-evident truths of logic and mathematics, which are mental creations, they reflect my patterns of thinking as a human being, they reflect what I consider self-evidently true as a mind. Why are those self-evident mental truths applicable to the physical world, which is supposedly not mental at all? How can there be such a match? What nature seems to know how we think and to reflect how we think, or even to be how we think.
Yes, that's right.
So that's very tricky for physicalists. What I would say, in my view, mind is the underlying substrate of all nature, and we are just dissociated complexes, dissociated personalities, if you will, of a universal consciousness. The reason why what I consider self-evidently true in my mind applies to the universe at large is that my mind is continuous with the universe at large. And therefore, the universe at large is mental too. It is essentially mind at work.
Yes, that is brilliant. Yes. here's the thing. You and I have come at the same questions from opposite directions. This is what I love about what I do, one of the many things I love about what I do. And yet, I agree with everything you're saying, and I think you would agree with everything I would say, except I want you to be the one who does the talking this time. But I have an explanation, which I can give to you probably. I'll send you an email that makes sense based upon what not – reasoning from math or materialism, but reasoning instead from what we are being told by the people we used to think were dead. And it all fits perfectly and it all makes sense. But the whole notion of, how would you describe consciousness? What would you call it?
Consciousness is that whose excitations, whose patterns of excitation are what we call experiences. The experience of seeing the color red on an apple, the experience of having a bellyache, the experience of falling in love. All these are excitations, patterns of excitations of consciousness.
The way that we who are working with what the dead tell us would describe it based upon all of our research is that it's an energy-like potentiality without size or form, alive in the sense that your mind is alive, highly emotional and probably self-aware. And it does include every human mind, just as you have reasoned from your science to that exact same position. Our minds are all part of that inextricably. The way, a bit of air you release into a room becomes part of that air. That's how our minds are connected. That's how what we would say. Now, I don't know how you feel about that.
If consciousness as a concept is a mystery and we try to unravel that mystery and make sense of it, make it more clear, it's difficult to then, in that explanation, use another word that is in itself is also a mystery, like energy. Energy is something that has a fluid conceptual definition. We have operational definitions for energy. We know how to calculate it. But when you pin people down and say, okay, but what exactly is energy? It becomes more complicated.
Yes.
I understand that you used it in a metaphorical sense.
Yes.
You're appealing to the intuition of people. I think that's valid. I'm trying to come at it from a conceptually clear angle. So I would not use the word energy to characterize consciousness because I'm mixing two concepts that are not clearly defined, if you know what I mean.
Everyone, are you here? I'm enjoying this so much, Bernardo. I just have to tell you, because we are thinking in much different ways, but we're coming to the same place. By the way, I didn't make up that definition. It's just the best one I've ever found among people who came at it the same way I did. Whatever it is that we call consciousness is enormously affected by emotions. And that's a whole other conversation I look forward to having with you at a later date, which is, and it's immensely creative. It is as you've said, it's what underlies everything. It's what Dr. Planck said. But I don't think I think it's unique, as you have said. It's unique in ways that we really don't even need to define it precisely. It's easier to say what it's not than to say what it is, probably.
Consciousness is all we've ever known, right?
That's right.
Whatever is outside and has been always outside our consciousness might as well never have existed.
That is profound, and that is really true. In Scientific American, there recently was an article about how they had finally proven that two different people will have that. I can't even express. This is how much I'm not a physicist. I've never even had a course in physics or, by the way, passed Algebra 2. But they have confirmed what you were talking about, this hypothesis that two different people can create two different realities, which was posited and indeed is true. I think it comes out of those earliest quantum mechanics experiments right at the beginning. It's just that they wanted to be able to prove it. And now, as you say, they have proven it. Astonishing.
That's indeed a very profound result. It has been predicted since very early on. Quantum mechanics, basically, if you follow the implications of quantum theory, you get to the conclusion that two different observers of the same observed system can describe that system in two different yet correct ways.
Oh, wow. That's
basically the prediction that was verified recently. So what that does, it corroborates an interpretation of quantum mechanics that's called relational quantum mechanics, was originally posited by physicist Carlo Rovelli in 1994, I believe. And it's an interpretation. Ravelli is a physicist, not a philosopher. So when he explained his interpretation, he basically said he admitted that there are huge philosophical qualms that his interpretation raises, and he makes no attempt to resolve them, to address them. For instance, one of the qualms is, okay, if the world, the physical world around me is a result of the information I have of what's out there, and somebody else looking at the same world can describe that world in a different way, yet also correct, the implication is that I live in my own physical world, and you, Roberta, live in your own physical world, and we are not sharing a physical world. So is it solipsism? One of the questions that that are raised from Rovelli's relational quantum mechanics. I tried recently, past few years, to provide a philosophical underpinning for relational quantum mechanics. And in summary, what I argue is the following. Indeed, each one of us lives in our own private physical world. And by physical world, I mean a world of objects with definite physical properties like form, weight, color, and so on, occupying definite positions in space and time. An object that is on the table is on the table and it's not on the floor. This is what I call the physical world. And the physical world that I have is unique to me. I inhabit a physical bubble around my subjectivity as an observer. And you inhabit another bubble, another physical world, and my cat yet another. Yet, this does not imply solipsism, because I do think there is a shared environment out there. It's just that the shared environment out there is not physical. It is mental. It's a superposition of thoughts, if you will. And here I'm using the word.
Yes.
I'm using the word thought here in a metaphorical way. I mean mentation that is not perception. That's what I mean. But okay, let's go along with thoughts. Uh-huh. There is a world of superposed thoughts out there, which we model as a wave function, as, you know, jargon in quantum mechanics. Anyway, we have a mathematical model for that world of superposed thoughts out there. It is not physical in the sense that it entails no definite physical properties, no definite position in space-time. It's just a realm of possibilities, of potentialities, all overlapping one another in a superposition. And the physical world arises when my personal subjectivity interacts with those superposed thoughts. The interference pattern of this interaction creates this bubble of physicality around me. And therefore, my physical world is consistent with yours, because your bubble of physicality arises from an interaction with that same environment of superposed thoughts. And my cat's world arises from an interaction with that same environment of superposed thoughts. So our physical worlds are different in the sense that two cars of the same make, year, and model are different, but yet indistinguishable. That's what I put forward. So we all think we are inhabiting the same physical world because our physical worlds are mutually consistent. They are cars of the same year, make, and model, but yet they are different cars. I am in my car and you are in yours.
Yes, I love it. That is beautiful. That is just beautiful. I had hoped we'd spend a lot of time talking about time. I should just say I met Dr. Kastrup when I was reading, you know, through what was in Scientific American, I guess a few months ago, I'm not sure when, and came across his blog post about time. Now, the fact that it was in Scientific American means it had kind of a good housekeeping seal on it. This is someone we think is a real good scientist. And he was talking, he was way ahead of me on time. My whole understanding of the nature of time comes from what we learn in studying the afterlife, and it already blows your mind. Can you share with my listeners what your insights were about time that really blew my mind? That's when I fell in love with your thinking, and having watched you a bunch now, I'm really in love with it. I think you are going to be the nexus between what Deepak and I and a whole lot of other people have for our lives been trying to help people understand, and the scientists who think we're all stupid. But you are you are the one who's going to make this link happen, and I'm so excited about it. But talk about time, Bernardo.
Big responsibility you just laid on my shoulders.
Yes, I did, but I'm sure you're up to it.
You would be amazed how open the question of time is in both philosophy and physics. People are all over the place. We have a sort of an operational understanding of time. It seems to flow linearly and to only flow in one direction. But when you really explore the details of the question of time, people are all over the place. There are physicists who think that time does not exist at all. Other physicists think that time is the only thing that exists and space is an illusion. There are physicists who think that space-time is absolute. Others who think that space-time emerges from certain quantum-level phenomena. In other words, space-time is not a pre-existing scaffolding in nature. Space-time itself arises as a quantum-level phenomenon. These are the people working on so-called loop quantum gravity. What I put forward in the Scientific American essay is an attempt to counter what some people see as an argument for the existence of time, which is that we seem to experience time. So yes. There must be time because we experience time. We experience flow from past, present to future. And my article was an attempt to deny that, to say that we don't experience time at all.
We never experience time.
Yeah.
Yes.
The notion of time is a conceptual notion that's very tempting to make. It is so tempting that we end up thinking that we experience it, but we don't. All that we experience is the present. The past are memories experienced in the present. The future are expectations or fears, possibilities that we experience in the present as well. We are only ever in the present. What we call time are themselves certain is itself a combination of qualities of experience that are experienced now. There is no experience of time, and therefore one should not use the supposed experience of time in physics or in philosophy to argue a certain position.
That is so beautiful, and it's absolutely right. The more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know, you just have given us a very basic insight, and which is perfectly consistent with what we learned from the work we're doing with the people that we used to think were dead, who are actually more alive than we are, and a lot smarter. One of the things that we're very recently coming to understand is that creation didn't happen a long time ago and just sort of like a clockwork machine go forward. Instead, it is happening instant by instant, micro instant by micro instant, which means if that is true, and that's a theory, but I think that there's so much evidence for it that we're going to end up with it in the end. If that's true, then we can't even say that the memories we have are anything other than what we have in this instant, which means that if that is right, it means that it really did. What you think you did this morning when you brushed your teeth really didn't happen that way necessarily, because the memory could be very different now in this micro instant of creation. I don't even want you to respond to that unless you feel like it, because you know, you may be thinking this woman I thought was nice is now off the rails. But this seems to be where the dead are leading us, that it isn't something that once started. It's something, and one of the reasons, for example, that the cosmological constants keep adjusting, even though the scientists say they don't, they do, is because, in fact, they're being renewed in each micro instant. How's that for making your eyes cross?
Well, I will not comment on the last part of what you said, but I will make a comment.
Yes, please, go ahead. I'd love to hear what you say.
You know, it seems Immanuel Kant and then Schopenhauer after him, you know, at the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century, they already put forward that space and time is a cognitive construct of our minds as individual human beings. Space and time is not something that is out there in nature, in the noumena, as Kant would say, or in the will, as Schopenhauer would say. It's not something we inhabit as individual conscious beings. Space and time is part of our cognitive apparatus. The space-time scaffolding exists in our mind. We distribute the contents of our experience in that scaffolding of space-time. We populate it. We create it as an artifact or as a means of our cognition as individual conscious beings. If that's the case, then if you are dead and you're not creating the scaffolding of space-time, what's your reality, right? To think of the dead in terms of space-time is to think of the dead in terms of something that's not applicable to them. because space-time is then my cognitive scaffolding as a living human being. It's a limitation that I have as a living being, so to say. So I think lots of the questions that people try to address in near-death studies or near-death experience studies, including the notion of the continuity of personal identity, which I'm sort of agnostic of. I'm not sure whether personal identity continues. But look at what I just said. Continues. That's already something that presupposes time, presupposes a space-time scaffolding,
yes,
which may not be applicable at all to the subject at hand, which is precisely what happens after you're dead, after the space-time scaffolding is not there anymore. It's not no longer valid. But we as human beings, we cannot think outside the framework of space-time. We think in a linguistic fashion, and language already has space-time built into it. Verbs, subjects, and objects. Space-time is built into language. We cannot think conceptually and logically without space-time, which limits discourse regarding the status of nature beyond space-time,
yes,
which would encompass the after-death state.
Yes. Well, because we have basically, we're cheating. We're talking with people who know what's really going on. And they're giving us insights, because this used to really make my eyes cross. So we had a lot more information from them. But here are some other thoughts. If all that exists is now, and I think you make a powerful case for all that exists is now, then if anything exists now, it always exists. Time is just not in anything we need to relate to. With regard to that, there is no time objectively in the afterlife, which is where my expertise lies, which is what has never made sense to me until very recently, and you helped me make it make sense. There is no space either, which is why they can go to the end of the universe in less than a heartbeat. So personality continues, but not as we would think it continues. It does for a brief period after we die, but we are much greater than these little personalities we have when we're on Earth, and we re-inhabit that much greater consciousness within. Because time doesn't apply there. I don't know when it happens, but it does happen after a certain point. So, fortunately, we do continue for all purposes because we exist now. We are eternal.
Yeah, I think you said something that's absolutely correct. If time does not exist, then everything that has been, is, or will be, all of it exists
now.
In the now. Yeah.
Yes. Don't you love this, everyone? Listen to this. This is a scientist and someone who came from an opposite direction. And truth is truth. You can get to truth from many different sources if you open your mind enough to accept the fact that truth comes from many directions. You are clearly a man on a mission, and you're very young, and you're already way ahead of most people who are much older than you are in terms of your thinking. Obviously, you're very bright. Where do you think your direction is going to be? What do you think the part is you may be able to play, or have you thought about that?
I have, and I have no answers. I don't really know, but strangely, I don't seem to care much. And I don't say that in a bad way. I say that in a good way. I feel I'm doing what I'm meant to do. And that gives me peace. I don't have a designed future that I expect to come or to be. So long as what I'm doing now resonates with what I feel I should be doing, somehow that's enough to me. And what will happen will happen. And if nothing happens, it's okay. As long as I have the feeling I've done what I could, I've done what I was meant to do. It's like it's not my responsibility how it will turn out, so long as I play my part.
Actually, what you just said is something we all should be thinking. And please pay attention to what he just said, everyone, because this is very important. Notice he said he feels centered in his life. He feels he's doing what he should be doing now. He's not looking for any particular outcome. Gee, I hope I win the Nobel Prize. I think you're on the short list, by the way, eventually. But we all have guides, especially one primary guide that we worked out this life with ahead of time. And that feeling that Dr. Kastrup has that he is where he should be and doing what he should be doing, that is his guide telling him at every moment that he's in the right place. He's following the plan. They try very hard to help us follow the plan. And if you start feeling out of control or off track, it's because you are. So opening yourself to what Spirit is telling you is the secret to getting back to where you should be. But now you are talking to lay people, but you're talking to lay people in an uncompromising way, which is what I love. I mean, you expect people to be able to understand what you're saying, even though for many people it's foreign. Have you thought about getting more popular in what you say? For example, you could write your most recent book for dummies and summarize it so that people who are – because one of the things I'm learning is more and more people are listening to Seek Reality, and I hear from them, is that people are hungry for a deeper understanding. But it's hard for them to get from where they are now, especially if that's deep in religion, which, by the way, we haven't even gotten to. That's going to be our next topic, I think, because that's one of the things that we talk about a lot here as well. And you have a lot of good thoughts about that. But helping people get from this sort of fear-based way of thinking, beliefs way of thinking, faith is a good thing, all of that, to a place of knowing, of understanding the way you live your life is based in facts. Why shouldn't your spiritual life be based in facts? Have you thought about helping people to make that leap in a very sort of popularist way?
Absolutely. That's how I started. I haven't planned my books out, if you know what I mean. I had an idea, a feeling, and I pursued it, and eventually the book was there. It was not something that I planned out in advance. Okay, that's what I'm going to do. I would strategize about my audience, who I'm going to target. And it was not like that. The book sort of, each book just arrived, just was there at some point. I just did what I felt was right at each moment, and at the end there was a book. But in my very first book, this feeling of the moment, what am I doing right now, was to reach the average lay person. That's what I wanted to do when I was writing that first book, and the same thing for the second, all the way to book number 6, which is a little bit more involved than book number 1. But I always had the lay person in my mind. They sold fairly well. I mean, they are not bestsellers. They sold fairly well. And then for book number 7, the one that has come out now, The Idea of the World, or The Idea, as people are calling it now, I just felt that I needed to do something that was not compromising. I didn't try to make it very accessible, or I did try, but without compromising the rigor, the clarity, the structure of the argument. I did not compromise on that. I thought at least one book will have to have the complete story as it is, without any compromise for accessibility, even though I would try to make it as accessible as possible without those compromises. And I thought, it's not going to sell as well as the previous books. Guess what? It is by far the fastest selling of all my books.
So glad to see that. That's
surprised
wonderful.
Me. It surprised me enormously. People seem to be eager to give themselves rational permission to believe what they already intuitively know is true.
That's right.
The mind is the bouncer of the heart, right? I like to say this. I say this right. All the time.
Yes.
Sometimes you already know intuitively that things are not quite the way they tell you it is, but your mind doesn't give you permission to embark on that, doesn't give you permission to experience that. Because the conceptual models running in your mind tell you that that should be impossible. And people seem to be eager to have a very rigorous, uncompromising articulation of an alternative worldview based on the same value system that materialists claim for themselves as the basis of their worldview, namely logical consistency, empirical adequacy, conceptual parsimony, all these values. These are the values I use to argue my case for something that is completely antithetical to materialism.
Yes.
And this seems to resonate a lot. That's what people wanted, it seems. They wanted to read and understand a non-compromising articulation of an alternative so they could give themselves permission to accept what they already knew.
Yes, that is so beautifully said. And it's really, I see it happening too. People, even 10 years ago, when the first of my books came out, I would be talking to an audience in very simple terms, and they would still look at me funny. They had no idea. Now, and I'm sure you're finding this when you speak as well, people are there, they get it, they already partly understand, and you're just helping them better fill in the blanks and fill in what they already know. It is a rapidly changing world intellectually, and that's very exciting for you, as it is for me. You're in the right time and in the right place. Tell everyone what your website is. I urge you to go there. There are videos on Bernardo's website that you'll really enjoy.
Yes, it's www.bernardokastrup.com, Kastrup with a K, K-A-S-T-R-U-P. If you go there, there are links to everything else, all my videos, papers, my second PhD thesis is now freely available there as well, links to the books. Everything is in there. There's a lot of free stuff.
Yeah, a lot of free stuff is always a good way to sort of lead things. Well, I'm thrilled. I'll be in touch with you. We will do this again. I feel as if I've made a new friend, and I'm so, so glad you're doing what you're doing now. So please consider yourself hugged, even though you're the other side of the world from me. And everyone, this has been really exciting for me. This has been Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. I'm really, really especially glad you were here today. Please never forget that you are a powerful, eternal being. You never began and you never will end. And when you really get what that means, it changes everything in your life for the better. Next week, we're going to be talking with Karen Anderson. She's an amazing pet communicator. She was last with us about 7 months ago by popular demand and talked about mental communication with cats and dogs, both those here and those no longer in bodies. She does a lot of work with horses, too. And my most important animal ever was a horse who was my buddy for almost 30 years. So I've invited her back to talk about horses in the afterlife and her experience communicating with horses, both living and dead. This is a little bit self-indulgent on my part, but I think you'll enjoy it too. Please join us next week. And this week, wow, we've been Bernardo Kastrup, who is that rarest of all people. He's an intellectually honest mainstream scientist. He's written extensively on many of the topics we mentioned here on Seek Reality, but as I've pointed out to you, from the opposite direction, and still we arrive at the same place. His most recent book, just out, is The Idea of the World, or as he says, just The Idea. The Idea of the World, a Multidisciplinary Argument for the Mental Nature of Reality. It's a terrific book. He's extremely bright, as you can see, and he can speak at the same time to both working scientists and lay researchers like you and me. And I think, like some of our other very recent guests, like Cyrus Kirkpatrick, he's the literal future of objective knowledge and understanding across all disciplines, as all their various insights converge in our search to finally know and understand what's true. I urge you to come to know Dr. Bernardo Kastrup. Like his mentor, who is the venerable Deepak Chopra, I think he is going to eventually be a household name. You heard it here first. As you know, my nonfiction books are Liberating Jesus, My Thomas, The Fun of Dying, a bunch of fun books, and a children's book called The Fun of Meeting Jesus, which is totally non-religious. Nothing I do is religious, as you know, if we've been together for a while. My books are available in bookstores and on Amazon.com, and the adult books, of course, are also available as audiobooks. If you want to talk about any of my books, or if you want to talk about anything at all, you can always contact me through the contact block on RobertaGrimes.com. I do answer every email. Just please be sure to give me your correct email address. Once in a while, I'll write a long email, and then it gets bounced because someone didn't give me the correct address. Makes me cranky, and you don't like to see me when I'm cranky. Past episodes of Seek Reality are available on webtalkradio.net, realrevolutionradio.com, and actually in a bunch of other places too at this point. More and more people tell me that now they just listen through the Seek Reality app that you can find for free in the iTunes App Store. But however you listen, I'm so thrilled to be in your life and to have you in mine. And if you ever wonder where Seek Reality can be heard right at this minute, just go to robertagrimes.com and click the radio tab. If you enjoy these weekly conversations, you also might want to check out my blog at robertagrimes.com. You'll get to it weekly if you sign up for it on my website. I talk about many of these issues, but we have a little more space there and we can go a bit deeper. And there's a group of people who can comment, so it's become kind of a forum. Meanwhile, this has been Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. Please enjoy and make the most of this coming week in our one reality. You are a powerful, eternal being, and you in particular, you are infinitely loved.
You've been listening to Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. Roberta blogs and answers questions at robertagrimes.com. Join us every week as we explore what the afterlife evidence and modern science combine to tell us is true about the one reality we all share. Knowing the truth changes everything.